Welcome to the Biblical Literacy Broadcast, where we study the principles of historical, grammatical, and literary interpretation of Scripture. With today's lesson, here's Dr. Andrew Sargent.
Jeremiah chapter 45, 1-5. When I was first married, this article stuck in my mind so much that I think about it often. A housewife. She woke up, smelled smoke, realized the house was on fire, gathered up her children, got them out of the house, took them out into the yard, set them under a tree, and then ran back into the house. When the firemen put out the fire, they found her charred body in the living room, clutching her purse. She'd gone back for her purse into the house. And it devastated me. I thought, what could possibly be in that purse that is so important that you would risk your life and die to get it? Of course, she didn't get it. She couldn't keep it. Well, in our particular situation today, we're gaining a little bit of insight into the life of a very famous man, Baruch. Basically, when you talk about non-prophet figures, you have the figure of the scribe Ezra, who was responsible for the restoration of the law and the restoration of the temple after the exile when the people of Israel came back to the land. And then you have Baruch. Baruch, a simple scribe who worked with Jeremiah to help change the nation of Israel, to try and save the nation of Israel when it was crumbling down at the end of its life. And what we see as we look into this passage is one piece of a story that is actually spread out throughout the book of Jeremiah. And it has to do with this phrase, the fourth year of Jehoiakim, and what it is that's happening in the fourth year of Jehoiakim that would cause this to be this moment. Now, what we have in chapter 25 is one of the main prophecies from the fourth year of Jehoiakim, which details what's happening at that time. Then we have in chapter 36 the event in which Jeremiah comes to Baruch and gives him a command from the Lord to do something for Jeremiah. And he does do it. No statements made. But when you come to chapter 45, you find out what was going on in Baruch's heart, in Baruch's life, when he was asked to do it in chapter 36. And it's a powerful psychological insight into what it means for us to be called into the service of Christ. It's a powerful illustration of what some sociologists call an SEE, a significant emotional event. The basic idea of an SEE, a significant emotional event, is that people don't really change that much through their lives. Early in their lives, their personalities become set, the patterns for their lives become set, and you find that they change in subtle ways. They maybe grow more curmudgeon-y as they get older. They maybe, go through the natural changes of what the body does to them. But mostly, as they change, they simply become more of what they were to begin with. They only deepen unless they undergo an SEE, a significant emotional event. And when they track these kinds of events in people's lives, they find that people are capable of amazing transformations in the face of a significant emotional event. What I want to focus on in the life of Baruch is we want to talk about the character, we want to talk about the call, we want to talk about the cry, because he's going to cry, and we want to talk about the correction, and we want to talk about the compensation. So what do we have? We have the character. Verse 1, this is the message which Jeremiah the prophet spoke to Baruch the son of Neriah when he had written down these words in a book at Jeremiah's dictation in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. So who was Baruch? Baruch is a relative of the king. He is a highly educated man. He is a scribe. Now a scribe in those days meant that you were like an elite college professor. You knew how to read and write. That was a big deal. You could probably read and write in many languages. So he was a highly educated man, and he had a great deal of promise. He was a scribe from a family of scribes. He was such a significant figure as a scribe that they've actually found archaeological evidence of this man's existence, not just in the Bible, where we have textual evidence, but actual archaeological. They have found seals that this man used in his work as a scribe for the royal house, because he was related to the king and he worked for the king. He would be like a cabinet member for the president. And he had all the hopes and all the ambitions that this position promised him. Wealth, fame, tremendous recognition, power. and everything that came with it. In fact, his brother, who is also a scribe from a family of scribes, is going to become the personal assistant to the last king of Judah. He's going to be his right-hand man. And this is the position that Baruch is up for. His whole life is mapped out before him, and he knows exactly what it's going to look like. He's going to have animals and property and servants and everything that anyone from that time period could possibly want. This is who Baruch is. This is the character. And then all of a sudden, one day, Jeremiah comes walking on up into his life, and things start getting a little complicated. All his plans and all his ambitions are put into tension when God's call comes into his life. And what is the nature of this call? The call is actually recorded in chapter 36. And it came to pass in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that this word came unto Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, take a scroll, a book, and write upon on it all the words that I have spoken unto you against Israel and against Judah and against all the nations from the day that I spoke to you from the days of Josiah even unto this day. It may be that the house of Judah will hear all the evil which I purpose to do unto them, that they may turn every man from his evil way, that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. Then Jeremiah called Baruch, the son of Neriah, and Baruch wrote from the mouth of Jeremiah all the words of the Lord which he had spoken unto him upon a roll of a book. And Jeremiah commanded to Baruch, saying, I am shut up. I cannot go into the house of the Lord. Therefore, go, you, and read in the roll which thou hast written from my mouth the words of the Lord in the ears of the people in the Lord's house upon the fast day. And also you shall read them in the ears of all Judah that come out of their cities, and it may be that they will present their supplications before the Lord and will return every one from his evil way. For great is the anger and the fury that the Lord has pronounced against the people. And Baruch, the son of Neriah, did according to all that Jeremiah the prophet commanded him, reading in the book the words of the Lord in the Lord's house. So what did he basically say? God has delivered a message that he is going to destroy Judah. In fact, Judah will be destroyed 19 years from this day. When Baruch is given his call, the people of Baruch have 19 years left. 19 years of their purposes, 19 years of their plans, 19 years of their sin, that is all that is left to them. And Jeremiah says, I want you, who have all these ambitions and all these hopes and all these plans and all this potential in the royal house, I want you to write down the curses which God has spoken against this people, and I want you to go into the temple on the fast day, and I want you to read it out loud. Now, what kinds of things are in that scroll? Well, we know generally that what's in that scroll is the curses that God is going to do, the destruction and the evil that he's about to bring against the land. But it gets a little worse if you understand what the fourth year of Jehoiakim is actually all about. The fourth year of Jehoiakim is the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, the great Assyrian king, the great and powerful ruler of the world, his father, Nabopolassar, overthrew the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians are the great enemies of the ancient Near East. They are a warring people. They were the first of the great empires. They were brutal terrors of the ancient world. Their nation became weak. And Nabopolassar, the first king of the new Babylonian power, and he went on the march to destroy the Assyrian Empire. And he, by 612... he had destroyed the city of Nineveh, a city that was considered to be unconquerable, impenetrable, and the Assyrians were on the run. They took their armies, they took their royal house, and they fled. And the Babylonians chased them across the world. And in 609, 4 years before this particular event, Josiah, the great king of Israel, the great hope of the nation of Judah, saw the demise of Assyria, and he was very happy. He was ecstatic. But the Egyptians, who had a covenant with the Assyrians, went to pass through the land of Israel to go north to help the Assyrians against the new Babylonian king. And Josiah didn't want this to happen. And so even though he was warned, he went north and he tried to get his army in the way of the Egyptians to slow the Egyptians down so that the Babylonians would have a chance to destroy the Assyrians because they hated the Assyrians so deeply. But what he didn't understand is that it was not the Assyrians that were going to be the great destroyers of Judah. It was the Babylonians that would rise up to be the destroyers of Judah. This is what Isaiah had promised them. Don't fear the Assyrians. Problem will be the Babylonians. When they come, everything is finished. And so Josiah actually gets himself killed. And the nation of Judah falls into a tremendous political darkness. And his son rises up to rule on the throne after him. And he only has these 4 years, from 609 until 605, which is the fourth year of Jehoiakim. And in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the battle pushes forward, and Nebuchadnezzar, who is the ruling lord of the armies of Babylon, who has not yet become king, he battles in the city of Carchemish against the Egyptians, and he crushes the Egyptian armies. Now, Judah is a land stuck smack dab in the middle of the great powers of the east, which is Assyria and Babylon, and the powers of the west, which is Egypt. And they're constantly being kicked around like a soccer ball between these powers. And at this point, in 605, the fourth year of Jehoiakim, when this passage takes place, the Egyptians have been broken. The Assyrians have been annihilated. And Nebuchadnezzar, whose father dies during this battle, not in the battle, but he dies back in Babylon at the time of this battle, Nebuchadnezzar rises to kingship. And the first thing he does is that he sweeps through the land of Judah, and he takes the best of all the people, and he takes them captive, and he drags them off to Babylon. This is the year that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are dragged into Babylon. This is a very important year in the life of Judah. And Judah is going to run around for 19 more years, but the death of Judah happens right here at this moment in time. This is a devastating time period. Now, what is Baruch going to do? What has he been asked to do? As unstable as the land is, he still has his ambitions. He still has his hopes. He still has all his plans. Everything that he wants for his life, everything he envisions it being. And I think we can all relate to that. I think most people have things they want their lives to be. But at this particular moment, he is being asked to give up all of his political ambitions. Because what is in that scroll? That scroll is traitorous. That scroll says that Judah is finished. That scroll says that Nebuchadnezzar is the servant of God. That Nebuchadnezzar, that wicked king who has just taken all the exiles away, who has just taken their king captive and dragged him out, that king who 4 years earlier put up a puppet on the throne, Jehoiakim, that king is God's servant doing the work of God. That king who is God's servant under the command of God is going to come and destroy the city of Jerusalem and destroy the temple of God, and is going to take all the people of the land, hundreds of thousands of people, take them captive into the land of Israel. It is pure traitorous propaganda. That's what's in that scroll. And Baruch, servant of the king, relative of the king, hopeful scribe of the king, is asked to go and read it in the temple on a fast day. And we have the privilege in this passage of watching him have a mental breakdown over the request, because we come to the passage. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to you, O Baruch. You said, ah. In Hebrew, it's literally, ah, ha, ha, ha. That's literally what it is in Hebrew. It is an anguished cry from the bowels of one's soul. Ah, ha, woe, woe is me. That means woe is what gets cried at a funeral. Woe is me. When you see someone yelling, woe, you're seeing somebody announcing death. Ah, woe is me. The Lord has added sorrow to my pain. I'm weary with my groaning, and I have found no rest. He is languishing. He is retching inside. He has just been put to it. There's a tension growing within his heart between his hopes and his ambitions and his dreams and everything he thought his life could be, everything he hoped, the big vision of his mind being flushed away, washed away, pushed away by the call of God. That one moment where he's asked to stand on behalf of his people. Because what is the hope of the message? Perhaps the people will hear and repent, and I will forgive them, and I will not have to destroy them like I've said I will. And Baruch has to choose. Do I throw my whole self into the saving of my people? Or do I continue for the next 19 years and build something great for myself? Do I create this wonderful, perfect vision of everything I want my life to be? Or do I give my heart and soul for my people on God's behalf? And the tension is there, and the tension is real. And it's easy for us to be hard on him, but if we understand what it is that he's being asked to do, I don't see brutality in this message from the Lord. I see the Lord bringing sense to him, bringing correction to him, but I don't see brutality or anger. I think God understands what it means to be human, what it is to have the tensions that he has. He knows what it is to be pulled and torn between the human desires, but he is in a dire situation. The people need him. And he's the man for the hour. And we know that he's going to obey. So we have the correction. And what is the correction? The correction after the cry, after the torturous screaming of his soul, the correction is, I'm going to destroy the whole land. What is it that you're holding on to? Baruch, what are you going to do? You're going to become the chief scribe to a king that's going to die? And when he dies, before he is killed, before he has his eyes put out of his head, the last thing he's going to see are all his sons murdered by Nebuchadnezzar at his feet. So the last thing he ever sees is the death of his children. You're going to be his right-hand man. You're going to build yourself a great house that you're going to live in for exactly 19 years. And then it will be gone with the rest of the land. Don't you get it, Baruch? I'm going to destroy everything. Death is coming to this land. This is not the time to be seeking great things for yourself. I love the way, I think it's the King James, seek ye great things for yourself, seek them not, for I will destroy the whole land. That's the correction. And it's sense. It's not anger. It's sense. What are you hanging on to? What is so valuable that it's worth holding in your charred hands when they find you dead? What is so valuable in this land? What's valuable are the people. It's the souls. It's the kingdom. It's the work of God. It's what God is doing and what God is calling. The correction is sense. Death is coming to this land, and you have an opportunity to stand on God's side to save souls, to build God's kingdom. You perchance have a chance, Baruch, to avert this disaster if this people will hear what you have to say. So what else is to be done? That's the correction. It's just plain sense. But what has he promised? Baruch, you're worried about this? Let me tell you what I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you something that your own ambitions can't give you. I'm going to give you your life. Thus you are to say to him, thus says the Lord, behold, what I have built, I am about to tear down. What I have planted, I am about to uproot. That is, the whole land. But you, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them. For behold, I am going to bring disaster on all flesh, declares the Lord. But I will give you your life as booty in all the places you may go. You want a reward, Baruch? You want great things for yourself? Let me tell you the great thing I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you your life. And that's something your brother, chief scribe to the last king of Judah, is not going to get. Because your brother is going to have 19 years. And when Nebuchadnezzar comes in and he slaughters his way through this land and he drags these people out, your life would be forfeit if you were a part of that system. But I'm going to give you your life wherever you go. Now, what actually happens to Baruch? Baruch becomes great. He does become great. But Baruch, in spite of the anxiety, in spite of the torture of his soul, in spite of the pain that he undergoes to sit there and hold all his ambitions and all his dreams in his hands, to sit there and to look at the facts of what God is doing and the call that is upon his life to stand in the gap, to be an instrument of salvation of souls, to be a man who possibly can avert the disaster of the kingdom by simply doing what God has called him to do in the last hour, but giving up these dreams, he gives them up. He lets them go, and he goes, and he is going to be driven into exile. He is going to be hated. He's going to be called a traitor. He's going to be beaten. He's going to have to risk his life to save his master, Jeremiah, when Jeremiah is thrown into a well and sinks down into the mud at the bottom of the well. He's going to risk his life when he has to confront the rebellious of the land. He is at every point going to be cursed and hated, but he's going to stand up. He's going to do the work of God. And when the kingdom falls down, when Judah is destroyed, when his family connected to the royal house is slaughtered or dragged into exile, Baruch is going to live. Baruch will become a great man, but he is going to become a man great in the things of God. Famous among all the scribes of the ancient world, the Jews still speak his name with reverence. This great man who gave up all his hopes and all his ambitions to do a great work for God. What do you even do with a passage like this? I mean, you can be cheap with it. You can come and sit here and say, you shouldn't be seeking to have careers. You people, we should only be evangelists. We should all go and become missionaries. Why are we all sitting here? Why are you buying houses and cars? Oh! No, that's cheap. That's a cheap way of handling this. That's not really looking at the reality of the world. Because the truth is that we're human beings and we have needs. We have needs as a physical being. We need to eat. We need to have shelter, we need clothes on our back, we need to concern ourselves with the needs of our body. We need friends, we need family, we need these kinds of things to sustain ourselves as human beings. It's the way God made us. We have social responsibilities. We need to be mothers and fathers and husbands and wives, parents. We need to be siblings. We need to take care of our parents as they get older. We need to take care of our children when they're young. We have all kinds of responsibilities that the Apostle Paul says that a believer who doesn't take care of his family is worse than an unbeliever. So I think to come and to be cheap and sit there and say, Jesus is coming back, the world is coming to an end, there's no time to be worrying about all these human things. No, that's cheap. No. So what do? As we are building our lives and buying homes and buying cars and taking care of the day-to-day needs that are very important to us. And I would never say they're not. They are absolutely vital. It's vital to be a good mother. It's vital to stay with your children, to raise them. It's vital to take those times for friendship and to have all these human needs. I don't want to have everybody running out the door like frantic little people going, oh, I gotta go save the dying world. We have to live like human beings. But what do? There could come a time in our lives where we face this type of a situation. This is Baruch's situation. Baruch is living in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. Baruch is living at a time when his nation has only 19 years left. And it calls for dire measures on his part in order to meet a dire situation. But we're in a marathon with Jesus. We've got a long way to go. We've got many years to fill. And unless God speaks a special word that says that our nation has 5 years left, then I'm going to suggest that we need to keep living our lives. But the tension that Baruch is facing is something that we all should know. We should know it if we know the call of God. We should know it if we understand the commission of Christ, what it means to be a Christian, to be called into the service of God. There should be some tension there between being people who lose ourselves in our daily responsibilities as opposed to people who meet our responsibilities as responsible Christians but are always mindful of the call of Christ, always mindful of the things that God is calling us to do. So I'll never ask you not to be human, not to live your lives, not to seek friendships. I'm going to go this afternoon, and I'm going to shoot pool with my son. And it's going to be a worthwhile Christian afternoon because I'm going to spend time with my boy as a good father, or at least a guy who's trying to look like a good father. How do you respond to this? If our situation isn't exactly the same, we should at least begin to wrestle with the tension. God has called each one of us to something. We're not all called to be evangelists. We're not all called to be pastors. We're not all called to be scholars. We're not all called to sell everything and go into the mission field, but we are all called. And the building of Christ's kingdom and living our lives in the service of God is a great time commitment. It's a great financial commitment as we're called to give and to dig deep, to dig generously, to pour out from our means, from our regular jobs that we have, to support the work of God, to support missionaries, to support evangelism, to build the church. It's a great financial commitment to be a Christian and to do the work of God and to fulfill our call to support the work of God. It's a great time commitment to show up to church, to show up to Bible studies, to take our own personal time in prayer, to take our personal time in the study of the Word. It's a great emotional commitment. It's a great moral commitment to say, even though my body, my whole being as a human being may crave out for certain things, that I have a responsibility to be moral. I have a responsibility to be ethical. I have a responsibility to be honest. I have responsibility to live my life like a Christian, to live my life like a person who knows that I will someday answer to God for the life that I've lived. I have an ethical responsibility, a moral responsibility, a financial responsibility, a time responsibility. And it will sometimes come into great tension with the other needs and the other desires and the other ambitions that we have for ourselves. I may never have my cabin in the woods on the lake or my 9-foot pool table with big screen TV and leather couch. But what I do have, if God grants me fullness of days, is I have about 35 years left of my life. What am I going to do with that 35 years? That's the gift that God has given me. Am I going to use my 35 years to do great things for myself? To do whatever it takes to have my house and my car, to have my cabin on a lake, to have my jet ski, to have my big pool table? Am I going to do anything and everything it takes to fill my life with all the great things and ambitions? Am I going to go out to make people think great things about me and say, ooh, he's so wonderful, look how rich he is, look how wonderful he is? Or am I going to take my 35 years and build something eternal, give something to God, to win souls, to teach his word, to live a life of moral, ethical responsibility, to pour what finances I can, what time I can, into God's kingdom, not to the neglect of my family, not to the neglect of being human, but to the neglect of all my selfish goals and selfish ambitions as I struggle and wrestle with the tension between what I want and what Christ wants from me? How many years do you have left? Some of you have more than 35 years, some of you a lot less. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with the years that you have left? Seek ye great things for yourself? Seek them not. Death is coming for each of us. I've got 35 years, and believe me, I count it every day. Something happened to me right around the time I turned 40. I suddenly started thinking that way a lot. I've only got 35 years left. I'm more than halfway through. What am I going to do with my life? Death is coming. The question is, what will they find clutched in your hand when they find your body? Eternal things? A life lived to do great things for God? Or will they find you clutching a purse?
We'd like to invite each of you to join us every Monday night from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. for the Biblical Literacy Ministries lecture series at New Hope Christian Church on Route 6 in Swansea, Mass., just around the corner from the Swansea Mall. Our present study is called The Man Behind the Curtain, A Conceptual Background to Biblical Theology. Starting January 21st, we'll begin a new series called Meeting the Jesus of Mark, An Introduction to the Biblical Theology of Mark. We hope to see you there.
You've been listening to the Biblical Literacy Broadcast. If you'd like more information about Biblical Literacy Ministries, visit our website, blministries.net. When you visit, download a recent broadcast and learn of upcoming events. If you'd like to support this ministry, click on the support button at our website, blministries.net, or call 774-265-2453. And join us again next week as we continue our study of biblical interpretation.